From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. The fact that American cars are not all that American is old news. But as it turns out, Japanese cars aren't all that Japanese. And then there's the Canadian connection, and it just goes on from there. Warren Brown reports for the Washington Post on the automotive industry. He has written a new book, All American Cars and Trucks. I'll speak with him about the American car industry, as well as the effects of technology on the cars we buy today. I'll also speak with Dr. David Rassen, formerly the Assistant Secretary of Energy for Nuclear Energy. Dr. Rassen is a past president of the American Nuclear Society. We'll talk to him about a new international agreement. The United States will finance a factory in Russia to convert uranium used in making nuclear bombs to fuel for nuclear power plants. Given the state of the economy over the last few years, many of us have put off buying a new car. Warren Brown writes the syndicated column Weekend on Wheels. I asked him just what new technology car buyers can expect to see today.
Obviously, airbags, Moira. It's, in terms of becoming standard equipment, 1994, about maybe 60% of all of the new cars sold have at least a driver's airbag. By 1998, under federal mandate, all cars and light trucks, minivans, sport utility vehicles, pickup trucks, are going to have dual-side airbags. And along with the airbags, which help to reduce facial and chest injuries, we also had an increase in lawsuits from people who survived those accidents because they had some injuries to the lower extremities. Also, there have been a crop of lawsuits springing up around folks who relied on the airbags without using the seat belts. And so you had some fatalities in those accidents, and sometimes families come back and say that the airbag should have saved them, and the answer is no, it should not have, not without the use of the seatbelt, and say a side impact collision. So that's one thing. Now you're beginning to see General Motors has begun to push anti-lock braking systems, which are basically a computerized device to pump the brakes in panic stops. The practical reality of that is keeps you straight. It stops you from going into a skid, but it does not necessarily decrease stopping distance. And unfortunately, perhaps in a way we've written about it in the media, or perhaps in a way it's been advertised, the general public walks away with the idea that if I have an ABS, an anti-lock braking system, that somehow I could go to the edge just a little bit more closely and hit the brakes and I'll stop more quickly. You will not. The stopping distance is not decreased, but your control over vehicle dynamics, you know, how the vehicle skids or moves to the side, that is increased, but not stopping distance per se. And so, you know, folks should be aware of that. And certainly when you look at new side impact barrier protection in both cars and trucks, moving away from the ruffled distill beam approach to computer-designed bars in the doors and around the B pillar, the center pillar structure, of the cars and trucks, to give folks a better chance of withstanding side impact collisions. And also something, a lot of people write me and they say, "Geez, Warren, I just paid $20-some thousand for this wonderful new car. I was involved in an accident that barely exceeded 15 miles per hour, and my entire front end is gone." New cars and trucks, certainly new cars, are designed to die before you do. The idea.
I like that. As a matter of fact.
Exactly right. The idea is to manage crash energy forces, and so therefore most new cars certainly are designed so that the front end will crumple, take a lot of the crash, the rear end will crumple, take a lot of the crash energy before that energy is transmitted to the passenger cabin. And another thing is traction control, also misunderstood. Basically what traction control does is to reduce wheel spin, say starting from stop on a slippery surface, or to warn you that you are in a tenuous situation. on a slippery surface. I mean, like the wheels will sort of retard. It almost works just the opposite of ABS. The wheels will sort of slow down. You get a kind of a buzzing sound, a feedback, an audible, and also a vibrational feedback in some cases, with traction control. And what you should not do is increase speed when it happens. When that happens, what the car is telling you, look, Turkey, this is dangerous territory, slow down. So it's, common sense. That's, that's really should be the new technology.
You know, so many people say, oh my goodness, you know, look at what these cars cost. You know, it must be labor and raw materials. A lot of the cost that you see that results in price sounds like it's this technology
and more costs are going in. I was just looking at the figures the other day. American Automobile Manufacturers Association and the Japanese Automobile Manufacturers Association, they're always publishing these numbers. The aggregate, the average cost of a new car back in 1980 barely exceeded $8,000. The average cost of a new car in 1994, the transaction cost, we're not talking about the suggested retail price, what it cost to get the thing out of the door on average, $18,300. That's a lot of money. That's the cost. But, the airbags don't come free of charge, and even though they're going to be mass-produced, you're still looking at combined cost of about maybe $400 per set, say, dual front. The increased side impact barrier protection, that's another thing. But also you have the whole thing of emissions control. You might have heard that recently the Environmental Protection Agency says that beginning for cars, I think in 1998, you will start phasing and onboard emissions control canisters, and that those canisters will go into trucks start going into trucks by the year 2001, 2006, right around in there. And this is where politics mates, with technology, because the argument certainly can be made that if the purpose of these canisters is to capture errant fueling vapors, you can do what you do in California, and that is you have the baffles at the pump to capture them and to reroute them into an underground storage tank. And presumably, that makes more sense. However, you have something called the petroleum industry, which says we don't particularly like that idea. It tickled me to no end to see environmentalists and a number of consumer groups climbing into bed with the petroleum industry on this one. Because the environmental folks and the consumer groups favor, quote, doing it to the car, again. And, of course, the car company says, no, you guys, no. So EPA has now decided that the car companies should put these canisters in. And essentially what these canisters will do is capture refueling vapors, reroute them to the canister, and thereby keep them from escaping into the atmosphere, we hope. At least that's the plan.
Right. Well, this is sort of actually fairly new in terms of years. I mean, the car is fairly new if you look universally.
Yeah.
But the role of federal government in dictating, what has to
occur. It became very Washington. If you're a student of Washington, the currency of Washington is power, more than money, more than anything else. The currency of Washington is power, and power wears many faces in Washington. It wears the face of altruism. It wears the face of doing it for the people, all of this kind of stuff, and it also wears the face of environmentalism and everything else. So that whenever you create a vacuum, which is what the auto industry did by being negligent on a number of safety things and on a number of emissions control things, you basically have people who says, look, we're going to force you guys to do this, which is what happened. So beginning, with Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, and going on from there, the early 1960s, you have an absolute cult of regulation, as it applies to the automobile. Safety, emissions control, all of these regs, they're not cheap. Do we need them? Yes, we need them. Has there ever been any real cost-benefit analysis in terms of what you're getting for what you're putting in? No. Is there even a rapprochement between the EPA and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration? No. EPA says, we want to do this for emissions control. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says, we want to do this for safety. Presumably they have physicists on both staff who don't talk to one another because sometimes things cancel out.
But often when technology becomes part of regulation, at the moment the regulation is passed, they look at the present state of technology. Mm-hmm. The technology is always moving forward. The regulation doesn't change.
I am so happy you said that, Mara, because one of the things that absolutely amazes me is what I call the era of sanctifying a given bit of technology, i.e. airbags. Do they work? Yes. Do I like to see them in cars and trucks? Yes. Are they the optimum technology? There are any number of people who say that this is the optimum, crash impact occupant, technology. But suppose somebody out there has a better idea or a less expensive idea. To what extent are they precluded by the conventional wisdom now widely accepted that this is a technology? Technology is not static, it's kinetic. And it would be nice if the politicians and the people who push for the regs understand that you're right. When regs get in, they tend to stay there unless some externality, i.e. an increase in accidents resulting from something or some unforeseen type thing, forces them to go back and change it. So,
my guest today is Warren Brown, syndicated columnist from The Washington Post and author of All American Cars and Trucks. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. The name of your book is All American Cars mm-hmm. and Trucks, and yet you include Honda, Nissan, Toyota, Mitsubishi. Okay, I'm a little confused.
Well, that's the North American Free Trade Agreement. definition of American. And actually, if you really think about it, it is much what America is, a collection of immigrants, all looking for a little bit of freedom and a little bit of cash, which is what these cars are doing. But the reason why Toyota is in there is that my definition is anything built and sold in North America. And containing at least by federal standards 50% U.S. content. Now, the only problem with that definition, Mara, is that there are a number of competing federal standards. For example, the folks who make the federal fuel economy regs say 75% U.S. content, which basically means...
Which means that's an American car.
Which they say that that's an American car. But because of those federal fuel economy regs, right, under that definition... The Ford Crown Victoria, widely used by many police departments, is not an American car. And it is not an American car because Ford decided that in order to avoid having the more fuel-consumptive Crown Victoria included in its domestic fleet, it would reduce the domestic content to 74%, 73%, push it into the foreign fleet, where it has a better fuel economy rating and not really affected, and then you have the conundrum of the Camaro and the Firebird. General Motors tells us that it's from the country that gave us rock and roll, and I assume that the good folks at GM by that mean designed in the country that gave us rock and roll, because I don't think Elvis Presley was born in Canada, which is basically where
where they're made.
And then you have the Toyota Camry, which is made down in Kentucky, the Nissan Sentra in Tennessee, Mazda 626, and you can't get more American than Flat Rock, Michigan, and so therefore. That's my definition of American. It's a generous definition.
Well, let's talk about American cars. I mean, the Ford Taurus and the Taurus station wagon really bailed Ford out. There's no mm-hmm. doubt about it. And I see now this new Ford Escort station wagon, which looks like a mini Ford Taurus.
Yeah.
Now, is that really a mini Ford Taurus,
or is that a fake?
It's
a fake in a way. What it really is, though, it's a Mazda Protégé.
What?
Yes, that is not an Escort. That is a Mazda-made Escort, which is based on the Mazda Protégé car and the Mazda 323. This, as the Mazda Navajo Sport Utility Vehicle you see, is not a Mazda at all. That is a Ford Explorer with two doors made in Kentucky. Now, we get even more complicated because I'm getting all of these calls from people who say, geez, I must have that Honda Passport. Well, folks, you can have that Honda Passport, particularly if you travel to Indiana and buy it as an Isuzu Rodeo, because that's what it is. you have lots of crossbreeding going on, primarily because the going-in cost on developing a new car or truck, certainly a new car, is so doggone expensive, anywhere from $1 billion to, if you're going to do, as Ford Motor Company is doing, developing a whole line of so-called world cars, $6 billion.
Now, what's the role of the local dealership now that we have these international crossbreeding? And
well, you know, the local dealers are going to have to start understanding that they have to have a supermarket mentality. They have to have, it seems to me, more of a Nordstrom's mentality. In other words, local dealers usually are always dualed, meaning that they sell more than one product. And if you are selling more than one product, then it doesn't become so much the product you are selling. You know, let the manufacturer put its money behind that. But as a dealer, it seems to me that you really have to sell people service. Now, forget all of these silly, goofy, you know, girly-whirly commercials and all of the banging on the drums and the cellophane and all of this stuff that basically insults the intelligence of even the illiterate, you know, and start focusing on what you're going to do in terms of quality. There is, I believe, out in Portland, Oregon, you know, one dealer who has a really common-sense advertisement, and in it he says, it's okay if you call me over the telephone. We'll give you the information over the telephone, and we won't call you back.
It's okay. We promise.
You know, and he doesn't. And you can come into our showroom, and we're going to assume that you've done your homework and what have you. And if you need assistance, we would be more than happy to give it to you. In other words, this kind of approach. It doesn't mean that this dealer is going to be less profitable. Indeed, the numbers are showing that, you know, he is quite successful. So, you know, the whole system of retailing, a lot of the system of automotive retailing is based on something called the Hall-Dobbs system. It came about maybe 1948, 1949, came out of Tennessee, and it was basically a dealership chain down in Tennessee, and they perfected the notion of the system. As a matter of fact, you can go almost anywhere around the United States, and you hear dealers talking about the system, the drill, some might call it, and what it consists of is greeting a person and then qualifying the person and then, you know, unhorsing the person either by, i.e., keeping him or her in a dealership so long that they forgot why they came in the first place, or in the old days, this egregious nonsense of somehow holding on to the license, all this kind of silly. Well, it's not that silly anymore. But the whole high-pressure technique, unfortunately, is still there too much. The whole, you know, business of, I think the University of Chicago did a study about 2 or 3 years ago where they were looking at dealer showroom attitudes towards women and minorities and we also found out in independent studies at the Washington Post that a lot of times what happens is that the salespeople, even if it isn't a policy of the dealership, they automatically put folks into a box. A woman coming in doesn't have a man with her. Well, you know, if the
easy
dealer,
mark.
Yes, precisely. If the dealer is unsophisticated, you know, easy mark. You know, forget about it. You know, sell her what we want to sell her. Minority comes in. Try to go for a maximum gross on a deal. You know, that sort of thing. That's beginning to change, all too slowly for my liking.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Warren Brown. For more than a decade, he's been on the staff of the Washington Post, and he's primarily responsible for covering the automobile industry. Warren, last year you were nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Now, tell me it wasn't for writing about what car to buy.
No, it was not. It was myself and my partner, Frank Sobota, who actually hired me on the financial staff of the Post. He used to be my editor, but he's now become a senior reporter. We wanted to try to show folks what happens at a place like General Motors and how General Motors at that time had gotten itself into trouble and what have you. And it was serendipity for us because just at that time, we didn't know. We just found out through reporting. There was a board move to dump, then Chairman Robert Stemple, because the feeling was that he was going too slowly, that he didn't really quite get the board's message. The board was under a lot of pressure indeed from even the state of California, from big pension fund shareholders to let's make this company profitable because our money is at stake here. And so we started following all of this, and we did a number of pieces basically showing, where GM had made some mistakes, the board dynamics of moving Stemple out, the whole kind of board revolution of trying to reshape GM and the tensions within the company itself. And it was a learning exercise for us. For a while, the folks at GM didn't like us, all that much. But now I think we have an understanding that they produce cars, we produce news, and sometimes we don't please one another.
Where is the American car industry going?
I think the future looks very bright. Look at Chrysler, for example, $777 million in profit for the fourth quarter. I mean, that's the best fourth quarter they've had since
10 years ago, they would have said, you're making it up.
It's incredible. I mean, almost everything Chrysler's turning out. But it's more than just product. When you look at what's happening at the big three companies, cost control now means more than just cutting down the number of bodies, working in the plants. It means working more intelligently. It means doing something that might have seemed obvious to me and you, that is, if you're going to design and build a car, it might be nice if the people in engineering actually talk to the people in production. It might be nice if the people in design talk to the people in engineering before you get to production. It might even be nice if everybody involved talks to the suppliers to make sure that the parts you want to go into this car actually exist. Which is something that they hadn't done before, which is why they had long, lines of fix-it, shops in the new car assembly plant. It was the funniest thing. 12 years ago, actually, when I started on this beat, I would go into assembly plant, and new cars, right, Mara? You figure, okay, so then new cars, you don't need anybody to fix them because they knew they just came off the line, except that you would have this long line of people at the end of the assembly line, literally, jimming the thing into place and making sure that it's right. So what does it tell you about quality? That has gone, and that is largely due to the Japanese, presence in the United States. Why? Because they forced the Americans to compete. And so now they're competing, and they have it down pat. Ironically, the American companies now understand what the Japanese companies understood all along from the late W. Edwards Deming, quality control, and that is a heck of a lot less costly to get the quality right the first time than they have to fix it, afterwards. Both in terms of customer satisfaction and also just manpower going in. So that's where we are right now.
That's right. That's engineering. And engineering is form and function.
Exactly.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you for one, but you might want to say two or three if you just can't choose. If I was to buy a new car this year that has legs, and by that I don't mean that I don't have to fix it, what are high school kids going and college kids going to want to drive 10 or 15 years ago that's new this year? Because it's great. It's fun. It's hot. It'll stay.
Well, this is when I don't even necessarily look at the car, but I look at the marketing departments and I look at the demographic and the psychographic departments in these various and sundry companies. And who is doing the best research there right now? Among the domestics, I think you have to say, Chrysler and Ford. Honda is now beginning to rediscover that art. And when you look at what these companies are producing, I think, this neon absolutely fascinates me because what it says for the first time is that somebody understands that economy doesn't have to mean it's devoid of libido. It doesn't have to mean, it doesn't have to mean that it's silly, and it doesn't have to mean that it's not safe. And what they've produced is a nice, cuddly, huggable little car. I hate that silly term, but it really is, that I think is going to sell extremely well. Honda, on the other hand, I think made an old GM-type mistake with the Accord. The Accord is a very good car. It's extremely well-designed. It will always sell well in the Washington metropolitan area, basically because we suffer from what I call the Crete, Nebraska syndrome. That is, we get everybody from small town USA, and all of a sudden we want to do the right thing. And Honda is very difficult to do the wrong thing with Honda, okay? But in terms of looking at the overall competition around Honda, this car has all of the elements, sexism here, of the Stepford wife. To me, it's a high honey car. It's a sterile marriage. It's kind of like going out of the door and, high honey, but we don't really mean anything. It's a celibate marriage. That's what the Honda Accord is. Right now. And the Nissan Altima, on the other hand, it has everything that the Honda Accord has, but it has something else, that little you know, that little what I call stylistic moment of truth that the car likes, and that is when you look at the thing, you like it, you know? So, you know, things like the Nissan Altima, the Dodge Neon, the Ford Mustang, which is an interesting exercise, I think, when you look at what Ford did with this old muscle car, the Mustang, versus what General Motors did with this old muscle car, the Camaro and Firebird. GM looked at the Camaro and Firebird and said, you know, we want to make, the best affordable sports, you know, muscle car that we can. And looking at the psychographics, you know, they were looking primarily at, you know, a largely male audience, and they've done a good job, which is not to say that women aren't going to buy that. I would imagine that probably with the 600 engine and stuff like that, you know, you're going to have...
Wait a minute. Well, I had a 68 Camaro,
uh-huh,
you know,
okay,
Kelly Green,
right,
black vinyl top,
yeah,
the big engine,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
My boyfriend drove the 65 Mustang.
Okay.
You know, give me a car like this.
Okay,
you
well...
know, there's women's lib has happened.
Okay, well, women's lib has happened, and everybody says it's an oversubject argument, so I'm telling you what happens when you look at the marketing departments, and you look at a lot of their, you know, their so-called clinic groups, and, you know, you talk to the folks, you talk to dealers, you talk to folks in marketing, and you talk to women's groups in general, and you say, well, a lot of women are going to buy this 600 car. They will tend not, for a number of reasons, to buy, you know, to buy the big V8, you know, Camaro. And also the Camaro Camaro and Firebird are very, very muscular. Now, what Ford did was it says, okay, we want to hold on to as much of that crowd as possible. But the realities of today's market are that women are 48% of the people literally going into the showrooms, putting down their money and taking a car out. And what Ford did, it was a very thorough psychographic of also what would make this car more pleasing to women. And I'm not talking about, you know, softer kind of nonsense.
Paint it
stuff.
Pink.
None of this nonsense. The performance is there. But other things are there. For example, when you fool with the dials, in the Mustang, if you have long fingernails, and I deliberately let my fingernails grow one time just basically to see what they were talking about, it doesn't hurt them or anything like this. And this was something that women said that they wanted. The attack of the angle of the seat belts, in the Mustang, assumes that not everybody who drives them are flat-chested. Okay,
that's true.
Exactly, right. And also, the fabric, a number of the fabrics in the Mustang are deliberately designed so that if you're getting in it, you know, with a dress, now guys won't notice it, so fine. So it's so
never
notice it, great. But women do notice it, is that you get into a car with a dress and it bunches up and it gets twisted every kind of way. They hate this, and this is what they told them. And so they said, give us a fabric that doesn't do that.
That slides.
That basically, you know, slides, or that at least is, you know, compatible. That doesn't fight me when I get into the car.
Warren, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest today has been Warren Brown. His Weekend on Wheels column is syndicated in over 150 newspapers, and his new book, All American Cars and Trucks, is published by National Press Books. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Agreement that started in the last days of the Bush administration and was finalized under the Clinton administration, the United States will buy radioactive uranium from dismantled Soviet nuclear weapons. Dr. David Rassen is a former Assistant Secretary of Energy. I asked him to tell us about this agreement.
When President Clinton was in the former Soviet Union in January of this year, he signed an agreement with the President of Ukraine and the President of Russia. And this agreement promises that missiles will be dismantled, missiles that had nuclear warheads. The enriched uranium that was in those warheads is going to be taken out, then mixed with natural uranium and diluted down to the point where it can never be used as weapons material again, and ultimately shipped to the United States, where we'll use it as fuel for ordinary nuclear power plants to produce electricity. This is one of these international agreements that sounds good, that could have been done sooner, but we're finally getting around to signing it. It finally has strong presidential support behind it and the officials of the other countries. And if it doesn't fall apart, it's good for all the parties.
A couple of things occur to me. First of all, how much does this have to do with disarmament? And, well, if you're going to disarm, we'll buy we'll buy stuff from you. How much does this have to do with the current economic situation in Russia and the Ukraine, the former Soviet Union? And how much does it have to do with our needs as a country in supplying nuclear power plants?
The first two, yes. The last one, not significant, but worth doing in order to accomplish the first two. The first one is to reduce world tensions by eliminating some nuclear weapons. That's something that I think there's general agreement that everybody would do if they could. Why would the Russians, or the Ukrainians for that matter, give up the prestige of having nuclear weapons? Well, for the Ukrainians, cash. For the Russians, cash. Your second point was, how much does it have to do with the economic condition of those countries? Everything. Here is a set of weapons that are no longer of any need at all. I mean, you can't even describe why a country would need these anymore. We have a lot of the same kind of things. We don't need them anymore either. The Cold War is over. We've got arsenals of weapons in the former Soviet Union and in the United States that were put together with the idea that we were going to be up against the world's mightiest adversary and both countries armed to the teeth. And now those days are gone, times have changed, and the Cold War is over. So even though neither Russia nor the United States will go from weapons to no weapons with this deal, it's a step in the right direction. And the reason they're willing to do it, even though they give up some international prestige, is because of money. They are bankrupt. They're maybe worse than bankrupt. And they desperately need hard currency, which they can only get from the West. Here's something that we can afford to buy, not because we desperately need it, but we can buy it for a price that to us is attractive, and introduce it into our market at a market price, which is basically the same as the material we have today. So the U.S. government will be the intermediary. There is a government corporation called the United States Enrichment Corporation, which prepares uranium for use in nuclear power fuel. And the U.S. government then will finance this operation with the Russians and the Ukrainians, sell the uranium to the U.S. Enrichment Corporation. U.S. Enrichment Corporation will sell it to the fuel market. Will it cost more? I don't know. It'll be close enough that it probably doesn't make any difference. And if it's 5% of the whole market in any given year, it's really not going to change the market price.
Now tell me about what the process is. What's coming out of the bombs? Where does it get moved? You know, how does it get moved? What changes where?
Let's take the missiles in the Ukraine as an ideal example. It's a special case, and it's the one that the phase of this that's going to be worked on first. First, there are missiles armed with nuclear warheads, and the first thing to do is to dismantle the electronics so that you can't make it explode anymore. That's easy. One of the things that made headlines out of this agreement was that they were going to change the aiming of the missiles so that they no longer would be aimed at the United States. That you can do with a little bit of software. I mean, that's no big deal. And in fact, you could put them back again in 20 minutes. But it made a good headline. And it's very important because it's symbolic of where we are. The next step will be actually to decommission these warheads so that they cannot be fired, and the agreement is to do that, and then the warheads, with or without the rest of the missiles, and I'm not sure how they're going to do this, will be shipped back to Russia. To some of the Ukrainians, this really bothers them, but again, it comes back to cash. The Ukrainians really were not managing these weapons anyway. The missile sites were staffed by Russian military people. They didn't include local Ukrainians in the specially trained cadres that were manning the missile sites. Only the Russians have the expertise to assemble these weapons, and they're the same ones that have the expertise to disassemble them. And probably the one secret part of this whole deal is that the Russians probably will agree to an accounting system so that the world will know that all the material ends up being handled and processed. But I'll be willing to bet that they won't show our experts the exact designs of the weapons themselves. We wouldn't show them. They won't show us. On the other hand, there are ways to handle this accounting and handle it in a way that the declared number of warheads can be processed and that you can show and prove that no material is diverted from the process and falls into the wrong hands. The key thing is to get the operation going. All right, now you asked about just what happens. Let me follow through on that. These warheads are made of what we call enriched uranium. There are two kinds of uranium. One is called uranium-235, and that has this amazing property of being able to split the uranium atom and release energy, and that is what makes nuclear power, and it also can make nuclear weapons. The other stuff is called uranium-238, and by and large, it's inert. It's heavy, just like the uranium-235, just slightly different, and that difference allows uranium-235 to undergo fission. In nature, only 0.7% of all the uranium, 0.7% is uranium-235. To make a bomb, at least any kind of a real weapon, you're talking about enriching it up to over 90% uranium-235. That's hard to do. We figured out how to do it in the Second World War, built huge plants at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and ultimately made the two of the first three atomic bombs that were exploded, the one test at Alamogordo and the two that were dropped on Japan, were made from uranium-235 enriched at Oak Ridge. The process was used for years to make some weapons material, although we really didn't make many uranium bombs. We used a lot of our enriched material for fuel for atomic subs. The Soviets did too, but they also had an arsenal of uranium-235 bombs, missile weapons. And so these are enriched more than 90%. Well, if you can enrich the stuff, that's hard. Diluting it down is much, much easier. However, they're going to have to build a facility in which this dilution can be done. It's not difficult on an engineering basis, but in order to satisfy us as far as accountability and everything else is concerned and security, it's not going to be a trivial process. The Russians say, we're willing to do this if you will help us finance it, and that's what we've agreed to do. So the Russians then will mix this highly enriched, very valuable uranium with natural uranium, dilute the 90% stuff down to 4%, like reactor fuel, which can't possibly ever be used as nuclear weapon without going through that whole original step, the very hard step. So for all practical purposes, it becomes non-weapons material. And the numbers I've seen indicate that to process this material that we get from Ukraine and some from the Russians, you're talking about 20 years of operation of this plant. So it's going to take time. The real question now is, can we get it going? Can the momentum of this signed agreement be used as a springboard to get the financial commitments there, to get the missiles moved from Ukraine to Russia and really implement the agreement? If it can, then all the pieces will come together.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. David Rawson. He is a former Assistant Secretary of Energy and past president of the American Nuclear Society. What's the time frame for building the factory and converting all of the highly enriched uranium and then shipping it over to the United States?
It always takes years to do something, and my guess would be that once the designs are completed, it'll probably take a couple of years to build the factory and get this process started. You're not going to build a factory big enough to do it all in 1 year anyway, and we really do see about 20 years of operation to take care of the whole quantity of material. On the other hand, there would be nothing stopping moving all the material into storage, safe storage, within that complex, so that it no longer is something that people can worry about for diversion or theft in a secured place, so that it can be guarded with military security. And then I think the whole world rests a little bit easier.
Now, by military security, do you mean U.S. military security?
I doubt it. We're talking about a sovereign state that that is generally regarded as the world's second most powerful military nation. I think for their own prestige, no, they regard it themselves. The Russians are very capable over the years of military security when the communist leadership was in power. My guess is that there are ways, even with the chaos that's going on in Russia and the other former Soviet states, for something critically important like this to provide military-type security. My guess is that the American government will ask for verification, accountability, such that we'll probably have a darn good idea of the level of security. But I think it would be diplomatically foolish to do it, to ask to do it ourselves.
What percentage of the nuclear arsenal of the Soviets do we suspect is these uranium-based nuclear weapons?
Well, I don't know. And those who do know probably won't tell us. And I'm not sure they know. After all, this is one of the most highly guarded secrets that we have. And certainly it's something that maybe our intelligence would like to know. My guess is that there are a lot of things that we wish we knew that we don't know.
How much uranium, and by that, I don't think most people know how big or small an amount of uranium is. How much uranium are we talking about in quantities that would go through this program?
It's hard for me to put it into kilograms or pounds. And once again, if I really know those answers, I wouldn't be able to tell you. We're talking about tons of material, or at least maybe something approaching a ton of weapons-grade material in this process. And there are other stockpiles in other places in the former Soviet Union, so that doesn't represent the whole picture at all. There may be many tons. I've heard numbers as high as several hundred. I've heard numbers as low as 100. So my guess is that what we're talking about here is maybe 10 or 20 tons of this material, but that's just a wild guess. The main objective, of course, is to move in the right direction. I don't know how many pounds of material go in a Soviet weapon. I don't know how many pounds go in ours. We know that you can achieve a critical mass with a relatively small number of pounds of material, 10, 12, something like that. We also know that a critical mass is not a weapon. People get hooked on the scenario of the high school chemistry student who's messing around in his basement and gets his hands on some material and knows how to design a bomb. Well, you don't just get your hands on this material. It's extremely valuable, extremely expensive, and extremely important, so it's very well safeguarded. The idea of the design for the bomb, I mean, that's textbook stuff. It was top secret 40 years ago, but it certainly isn't anymore. All kinds of bomb design ideas have been published. Tom Clancy's book has a great description of how a terrorist group might make a bomb, but it isn't thoroughly accurate, and it isn't enough for a terrorist to go out and design his own. That's a lot trickier than the science fiction stories. But there's a very important nuance here. It's one thing to say you know how to make an explosive device out of some nuclear material. It's another thing to make a weapon, something that can be actually utilized to either attack somebody or in retaliation for the defense of your own nation. Now you're talking about sophisticated systems that have to be reliable enough to risk the entire future of your defense on. this isn't high school chemistry stuff. This is extremely sophisticated that our scientists at Los Alamos and Sandia and Livermore have been working on for a long, long time. So when you're talking about weapons of defense, it's an entirely different ballgame than cartoons and comic books.
Now, the agreement basically says we're going to fund you to build this factory, and that will take a few years. And then as the low-grade uranium comes out, we'll pay you as it comes over to the United States. So it's an ongoing, it's sort of like a business deal.
That's right. And, you know, you can be a little more detailed in this and say that as we buy this material, we also provide the income to repay some of our investment in the factory. So there will be accounting going on over the years. That's why I say, like any complicated matter of diplomacy, this is fragile. All these pieces have to be there for this to work. And, you know, if people decide not to make it work, they can probably do that. That doesn't mean that you don't want to take the first step and do something that is a long-run benefit to society as a whole.
My guest today is Dr. David Rothen. He was formerly the director of the Nuclear Safety Analysis Center at EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, and his early research at Argonne National Laboratory was in the area of reactor safety and radiation effects on materials. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. How much do we anticipate in the current plan of the market in the United States for the low-grade uranium will be satisfied by this incoming uranium from Russia?
I think over a period of years it might average out to be 5% of our normal annual needs. It's not going to change the whole market picture in the U.S. And from that you can see that it's not really going to change the price or the cost of generating nuclear power. It's not going to change people's electric bills. But even if it did, even if it costs a little more, it seems to me that's a very reasonable price to pay for any kind of reduction in international tensions. We're, as a nation, I think, willing to continue to invest very heavily in defense. And our defense budget is still awfully, awfully big. And that tells me that the American people could certainly justify such a small investment that nobody would even see it in a deal like this, which ultimately does reduce international tensions, even if only by a little bit.
Such an agreement involves the State Department and clearly the Department of Energy.
Yeah. And the Department of Defense as well.
And the Department of Defense. How does such an agreement come to be? It seems so incredibly complicated.
I think it is incredibly complicated. I served a limited period of time as an assistant secretary with a cabinet-level agency, and people like to poke fun at bureaucrats. That's a fun word, the bureaucracy. The United States government and its contractors have some extremely high-quality talent. Very experienced people who can match in capability with anybody anywhere in the world. In addition to the people within the federal establishment, the ones we sometimes chide as being bureaucrats, in addition to them, we have our national laboratories. These are, by and large, not government employees. They're employees of government contractors. But they're really an extension of government. And there you do have perhaps the greatest reservoir of expertise anywhere in these matters. So when something like this is put together, there is going to be involvement, even though it's not broadcast, there is going to be involvement of some of the best scientists and the best technical people in the world, along with the people from the various agencies of government and those who have responsibility, the military and energy and state, working together to try and make sure that our position is a good one.
When we have to make regulations based on technology, we're limited by the technology today. when we try to make regulations of that to force technology development downstream, we can have problems. Talk about that subject.
Ideally, regulations should be like standards. That means you take a base of experience and you say, okay, here's our scientific evidence. Here's the goal we're trying to reach. We will now put regulations in place after a process of hearings and other things, develop a record and say, okay, we are going to set radiation standards, or we are going to set air pollution standards. And these standards are going to be something that can be achieved. And if you have to work hard to achieve it, okay. But we're going to set standards that are common sense, achievable standards that are not going to bankrupt the nation, and they're going to achieve the clean air goals, for example, that we want to achieve. There are some people who, and it's an interesting dichotomy, there are some people who really have an anger and a distrust of technology. These same people will turn around and say, okay, I want to pass a regulation that forces industry, forces the technologist to do something they've never done before. And I believe that if we just set a very stringent technological regulation and a very high goal, that we can put industry's feet to the fire, and if we do that and do it hard enough, it'll force them to do it. Now, this is idealism really pushed to a very high limit, because Mother Nature is a tough lady to deal with, and there are certain laws of physics that you just can't repeal overnight. So we've tried to do some of these things in the guise of technology forcing regulations that would force us to come up with something. Let me give you an example in my field, nuclear energy. Back in late 70s, Sweden passed, the parliament in Sweden passed a law saying we will not dam any more rivers. We've dammed enough rivers to make hydroelectric plants. We won't do that anymore. And so what we're going to do is make up for the energy that we can't get from the rivers with nuclear power plants. Fine. They also said we're not going to burn a lot of coal in Sweden. We want to keep the air clean. After all, we've got nuclear power plants. Then a political party won an election, and part of their platform was the phase-out of nuclear power. They won by a very narrow margin, but they put in place a plan which said we're going to phase out all of our nuclear plants by the year 2005, and we're going to start by shutting down the first two in 1995 and 96. Well, one of the things about electric power is it comes in big amounts, and if you're going to replace a large amount, like you get from a nuclear power plant, you've got to start planning for that and put it in place years ahead of time. If you're going to do it by conservation, you've got to see those conservation measures in place and the trends in place early enough so that you know whether you can build, whether you have to build something else or not. Well, in Sweden, it was obvious there were a couple of things were happening. One was they weren't building other things. Two, conservation wasn't happening. Their electricity use continued to go up with their economy. And three of the nuclear plants were working just fine. Now, here was a technology-forcing regulation, because some of the people who pushed on that regulation, their idea was that this regulation would force people to conserve. The labor unions and the business leaders in Sweden informed the parliament that this was intolerable. Production and jobs were leaving Sweden. Sweden was having to have to buy things overseas, hurting their balance of payments, and it was an intolerable situation. So what did the parliament do? Well, they didn't have the courage to just plain vote for a change. They didn't even have the courage to take it to the people for a referendum. They just voted through a measure to slip the shutdown date of the first plants by a year. And the next year, they voted again to slip it by a year. Always 8 or 9 years into the future. And not only did it work, but the people didn't mind at all. It didn't provoke any outcry. There was no hue and cry for doing something totally different. They were very happy that this issue could just be kind of slipped around and wouldn't have to worry anybody. And this year, they just voted to slip it another year. And this will go on for a while, but the piper pretty soon has to be paid. You have to replace old facilities. Demand continues to grow. And sooner or later, they're going to have to make some decisions about where their electricity is going to come from. It's either going to come from importing more oil or buying gas from Russia or damming rivers in these mountains that they don't want to do or building more nuclear power plants. In my view, the more likely scenario is that they'll build some more nuclear power plants like the ones they already have that, as I said, are working just fine, and the people don't seem to care one way or the other.
Well, we know where they can get some uranium at good prices.
They probably can, and they might want a piece of this deal.
Dr. Rasmussen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Maura.
My guest today has been Dr. David Rasmussen, a former Assistant Secretary of Energy. He is the immediate past president of the American Nuclear Society. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called supermolecule.
Water is a curious compound. Unlike most liquids, each molecule of water is weakly linked to its neighbors. So you can think of a glass of water not as trillions of independent molecules, but as a single, weakly bonded supermolecule. Consider the water sitting in the pipe leading to your kitchen sink faucet. When you turn the faucet on, you're releasing one tentacle of a gigantic molecule of water. That tentacle is connected to all the water in the network of distribution pipes linking your entire community. When someone else, a stranger on the far side of town, say, opens her faucet, she releases another tentacle of the huge monster. If both of you simultaneously put your hands under the flow, you're curiously connected to each other via the same supermolecule. If your community is like ours, your water comes from a reservoir in the hills. Normally, a dam cuts off the reservoir from water in a downstream river. But the two bodies of water, reservoir and river, are inevitably linked. Sometimes it's obvious, such as when water flows in a continuous stream over a spillway. Sometimes it's more subtle, since a trickle is always making its way under and around the dam through pores in the subsurface. Either way, it means that your tentacle is linked not only to water flowing from every other open faucet in town, but to the reservoir and the river and thence to the ocean. Now, the oceans of Earth, of course, are really just one big ocean. There's no wall, for instance, where the Atlantic meets the Pacific. So now we're talking about a really big molecule. When you put your hand in the flow from your faucet, you're physically linked through this single supermolecule with, you might imagine, a Yanomamo tribesman washing in a tributary of the Amazon 2,000 miles upstream of the Brazilian coast. And at that moment, the slogan, "Reach out and touch someone," takes on a whole new meaning.
Barry Evans writes the syndicated column Star Watch and is the author of Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.